Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. You're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today's Greatest Briton is T.E. Lawrence, and this is part two in our presentation on him. And of course, my co-host for the show is Max Musson from Western Spring. Shall we get into our Greatest Britons then for today, Max?
Yes, that'd be great.
Yeah, let's talk about an earlier period in British history. Our Greatest Briton for today is once again Lawrence of Arabia, and we will begin with a recap. In the last episode, we talked about the birth of Arab nationalism and how it grew from wanting Arabic language lessons in schools to demanding an Arab ethnostate from Damascus to Yemen. The British promised to help achieve this if the Arabs rose up against the Ottomans, which they did, with Lawrence leading them on many missions. However, the Sykes-Picot Agreement had already been made to divide the Middle East up between France and Britain in the event of the Ottomans losing, and the Arab ethnostate was just a short-lived kingdom in Syria. So the British went back on their word, and T.E. Lawrence was obviously upset about this. I mean, he must have been, and he really was leading them on so many of these missions. We went through them last week, a dozen or so missions that were actually led by Lawrence, and he really did live as the natives did. He dressed up as an Arab, he lived as the Arabs, he spoke Arabic, and he was seen pretty much as one of them. He got on very well with them. Max, do you want to add anything to this recap?
It's as you say, the Sykes-Picot Agreement had been made, which promised the various Arab groups their own Arab ethnostate. This was kind of in response to the rise of Arab nationalism and Baathism. We had compromised our ability to grant the Arabs what they wanted by virtue of the fact that the British government had made the Balfour Declaration during the First World War, which was intended to bring the United States into the war on the side of the Allies. And in order to do that, we promised Jewish organizations in America that we would make the Balfour Declaration granting the Jews a homeland in Palestine if the Jews in America used their influence in order to bring the United States into the war on our side. And, you know, they duly did that. And so we had promised two separate ethnic groups the same piece of land. And so it was a grave mistake of statecraft and politics that we had done that, and really the British government of the time was responsible for the Arab-Israeli conflict that's continued ever since.
Yeah, it makes you wonder which of the two ethnic groups did help out the most during the war. I mean, you could say, well, the Arabs, they rose up against the Ottomans and they succeeded in taking Syria. And then you can say, well, and the Jews brought the Americans in on our side during the war. Did the Americans help tip the scales of the balance so that we won the war, or was it the Arabs? Any thoughts on that, Max? Which one do you think had more effect on the outcome of the war, the Americans or the Arabs?
Well, that's quite a difficult one to estimate. I think, actually, in fairness, the Americans coming in on our side probably would have been a more influential thing. That would have been a bit more important, because the rivalry between Britain and Germany that had existed prior to World War One was one in which the Germans were a growing industrial power, whereas our industrial power to some extent was waning at that point. It was the industrial might of the United States providing the weaponry as well as the soldiers that I think probably tipped the balance, just as it did in the Second World War.
Yeah, I think I'd go along with that as well. It was the Americans that really helped out the most. And it was because of that, I guess, that it was the Jews that won out with that Balfour Declaration. Well, after the war ended, Lawrence returned to the United Kingdom a full colonel. Immediately after the war, he worked for the Foreign Office, attending the Paris Peace Conference between January and May as a member of Faisal's delegations. So I guess that was the Versailles Conference, and he was there as a member of the Arab delegation. On 17th of May 1919, a Handley Page Type 0400 taking Lawrence to Egypt crashed at the airport of Roma Centocelle. The pilot and co-pilot were killed, but Lawrence survived with a broken shoulder blade and two broken ribs. During his brief hospitalization, he was visited by King Victor Emmanuel III of Italy. So he was actually in a plane crash and he survived it, but the pilot and the co-pilot were killed. That's quite incredible to survive a plane crash like that. In 1918, Lowell Thomas went to Jerusalem where he met Lawrence, whose enigmatic figure in Arab uniform fired his imagination, in the words of author Rex Hall. Thomas and his cameraman, Harry Chase, shot a great deal of film and many photographs involving Lawrence. Thomas then produced a stage presentation entitled With Allenby in Palestine, which included a lecture, dancing and music, and engaged in Orientalism, depicting the Middle East as exotic, mysterious, sensuous and violent. The show premiered in New York in March 1919, and he was then invited to take his show to England, and he agreed to do so provided that he was personally invited by the King and provided the use of either Drury Lane or Covent Garden. He opened at Covent Garden on the 14th of August 1919 and continued for hundreds of lectures attended by the highest in the land. So I guess this is before the age of the cinema. So you would put on a show involving a lecture, dancing and music, and try to explain to people what this other part of the world was actually like. Well, initially, Lawrence played only a supporting role in the show, as the main focus was on Allenby's campaigns. But then Thomas realised that it was the photos of Lawrence dressed as a Bedouin which had captured the public's imagination. So he had Lawrence photographed again in London in his Arab dress. With the new photos, Thomas then relaunched his show under the new title, With Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia, in early 1920, which proved to be extremely popular. The new title elevated Lawrence from a supporting role to a co-star of the Near Eastern campaign and reflected a changed emphasis. Thomas's shows made the previously obscure Lawrence into a household name. Lawrence worked with Thomas on the creation of the presentation, answering many questions and posing for many photographs. However, after its success, he expressed regret about having been featured in it. So I guess lots of people must have been to see this, and this is where Lawrence really made his name. I guess there must have been lots of pictures of him in the newspapers as well. Any thoughts on Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia, Max?
Yeah, I was just sort of thinking there for a moment about what it was that made Lawrence regret having taken part in those productions, and I guess it probably was the fact that Allenby's nose would have been put out of joint, Allenby having been the superior officer and therefore wanting to take credit for the successes in organizing the Arabs for himself, and then finding that the person who he perhaps regarded as a bit of a flamboyant understudy sort of snatching the limelight from him and being the and sort of having the most or cutting the most kind of romantic picture and sort of capturing the public's imagination.
It also seems that Jews particularly like this, particularly Zionist Jews. And this bit of notes I get here comes from somewhere else. I think it was a review on this with Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia. And it says, on 9th of March 1919, Lowell Thomas gave his first performance of With Allenby in Palestine, later renamed With Allenby in Palestine and Lawrence in Arabia, at the Century Theatre in New York, a mile north of the theatre district in Midtown Manhattan. Packing the front row was a who's who of New York's banking families, Jacob Schiff, Otto Kahn, Nathan Strauss, Paul and Felix Warburg, as well as a Rothschild, were seated with their wives. After seeing the show, Schiff, a passionate Zionist, and the Warburgs were convinced that Americans needed to see and hear Thomas's tale of the war in the Holy Land. Once the season at the Century ended, they encouraged Thomas to move his travelogue to Madison Square Garden, bought large sections of seating for Thomas to give away to working-class New Yorkers, and even chartered buses to transport people from the Bronx. 6 years later, after a sold-out season in London and a worldwide tour of the rest of England, Scotland, Wales, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Ireland, Burma, British Malaya, Ceylon, and India, Thomas's travelogue had been delivered over 4,000 times. Total ticket sales exceeded 4 million, or roughly 1% of the population of the British Empire. So 1% of the British Empire actually went to see this show. It was that important. And these Zionist Jews thought it was particularly important, and they bought up a huge block of seating to give it away to working class New Yorkers. So I wonder what was going on there. Why was it that these Zionists so wanted working class New Yorkers to see this show? I mean, what was it that it was showing that these Jews wanted them to see? Any ideas, Max?
Well, one of the things it wouldn't have shown is that it wouldn't have shown Arabs tilling the land and growing olives and cereals and things of that sort, and involved in animal husbandry. It won't have featured Arabs engaged in commerce in the various cities of the Middle East. What it would have shown, because it would have been more in keeping with the legend of Lawrence of Arabia, is it would have shown Arabs as being a kind of a migrant population of no fixed abode. And it would have shown them very often in Bedouin garb. And so what it would have done is, on the one hand, you would have had the Zionists saying, oh, if we had that land, we could make that land blossom. We could irrigate the soil. We could plant olives. We could plant cereals. We could make it a very productive area. But just look what the Arabs are doing. So they're all charging around on camels shooting guns. And, you know, yes, it is very romantic and lovely that T.E. Lawrence managed to harness them and get them to drive the Ottomans out of Syria. We are the people who will civilize and cultivate the Holy Land.
Yeah, I think that must have been it. It must have been the way that it depicted the Arabs and the way that it depicted that area. I guess it must have shown that there really wasn't much there, because it was once the Jews went there with German help that they actually built cities and built up the area. I mean, it wasn't really a civilized area up until then. The Bedouins were traveling about on donkeys. And once these German Jews went there, they built roads and they had motor cars and they built industry and they built Tel Aviv and these various other cities that we hear about now that are over there in Israel. Most of that was built with German industry. And that was the argument that these Jews used as well, that, these Palestinian Arabs, they weren't doing anything with it and they were just traveling.
I don't think
about
it was quite as clear cut as that, though. In reality, I think that the Arabs probably did cultivate a lot of the land previously and were living in settlements, villages and small towns. That they probably didn't have any large cities, because they probably didn't have any need for large cities. So the large cities probably came later. But they wouldn't have been migrant people of no fixed abode. They would have been, a great many of them. It's only the Bedouins that would have been the people who were migrant peoples. The rest, which probably would have constituted the bulk of the Arab peoples, the peoples of Syria, etc., would have been settled people. And as I said last week, Damascus is the oldest city in the world. It's older than any other city, and the area of Syria around Damascus was the birthplace of cereal and land husbandry, which then spread during the Bronze Age, etc., into the rest of Europe.
Yeah, I guess it's just the modernization aspect of it. You know, people would have looked at that and just thought, well, these people are doing things, the ways that we were doing them 1,000 years ago. So it gave the Jews a chance to say, well, we can go in there and we can modernize it and we can build it up with our money. And they got their support for it in the end. Lawrence served as an advisor to Winston Churchill at the Colonial Office for just over a year, starting in February 1920. He hated bureaucratic work, writing on the 21st of May 1921 to Robert Graves, "I wish I hadn't gone out there. The Arabs are like a page I have turned over, and sequels are rotten things. I'm locked up here in the office every day, and much of it." He travelled to the Middle East on multiple occasions during this period, at one time holding the title of Chief Political Officer for Transjordania, and he campaigned for his and Churchill's vision of the Middle East, publishing pieces in multiple newspapers, including The Times, The Observer, The Daily Mail, and The Daily Express. So that's interesting. So, I mean, he must have supported the idea of the Jews having a homeland in Palestine, because Winston Churchill was a big supporter of that right since the beginning. So that must be what they mean here when they say that he campaigned for Churchill's vision of the Middle East. So he must have just accepted this Sykes-Picot line, and that Britain was going to have that bit, and that Britain should hand it over to the Jews. I mean, he must have accepted it, I think. Don't you think, Max?
I think so, yes.
Well, Lawrence had a sinister reputation in France during his lifetime, and even today as an implacable enemy of France, the man who was constantly stirring up the Syrians to rebel against French rule throughout the 1920s. However, French historian Maurice Leriz wrote that the real reason for France's problems in Syria was that the Syrians did not want to be ruled by France, and the French needed a scapegoat to blame for their difficulties in ruling the country. Leriz wrote that Lawrence is usually pictured in France as a Francophobe, but he was in reality a Francophile. So this is rather unfortunate. I mean, Lawrence did like France. He travelled around France, didn't he, in his youth, documenting all the castles there, and he was into all the Crusader history that went on in France. And yet, because he supported the Arabs in Syria, who wanted Syria for themselves, they didn't want to be under the French, he was seen as an enemy of France at the same time as being a hero in Britain. Well, having seen and admired the effective use of air power during the war, Lawrence enlisted in the Royal Air Force as an aircraftman under the pseudonym John Hume Ross in August 1922. So I guess if he'd enlisted under his name, they would have given him an officer's job. And I guess he wanted to actually get by on merit rather than on his name. At the RAF recruiting centre in Covent Garden, London, he was interviewed by recruiting officer, Flying Officer W.E. Johns, later known as the author of the Biggles series of novels. Johns rejected Lawrence's application, as he suspected that Ross was a false name. Lawrence admitted that this was so, and that he had provided false documents. He left, but returned sometime later with an RAF messenger who carried a written order that Johns must accept Lawrence. However, Lawrence was forced out of the RAF in February 1923 after his identity was exposed. He changed his name to T.E. Shaw, apparently as a consequence of his friendship with G.B. and Charlotte Shaw, and joined the Royal Tank Corps later that year. But he was unhappy there and repeatedly petitioned to rejoin the RAF, which finally readmitted him in August 1925. A fresh burst of publicity after the publication of Revolt in the Desert resulted in his assignment to bases at Karachi and Miramshar in British India, now Pakistan, in late 1926, where he remained until the end of 1928. At that time, he was forced to return to Britain after rumours began to circulate that he was again involved in espionage activities. He purchased several small plots of land in Chingford, built a hut and a swimming pool there, and visited frequently. The hut was removed in 1930 when Chingford Urban District Council acquired the land. It was given to the City of London Corporation, which re-erected it in the grounds of the Warren, Loftham. Lawrence's tenure of the Chingford land has now been commemorated by a plaque fixed on the sighting obelisk on Pole Hill. He then continued serving in the RAF, based at RAF Mountbatten near Plymouth, RAF Calshot near Southampton, and RAF Bridlington, East Riding of Yorkshire, and he specialised in high-speed boats and professed happiness, and he left the service with considerable regret at the end of his enlistment in March 1935. So he obviously really enjoyed being in the RAF. In late August or early September 1931, he stayed with Lady Houston aboard her luxury yacht, the Liberty, off Calshot, which is just off the Isle of Wight, shortly before the Schneider Trophy competition. And in later letters, Lady Houston would ask Lawrence's advice on obtaining a new chauffeur for her Rolls-Royce car. "Forgive my asking, but you know everything," she said, and suggested that he join the Liberty, for she had discharged her captain, who had turned out to be a wrong un. In the interwar period, the RAF's marine craft section began to commission air-sea rescue launches capable of higher speeds and greater capacity, and the arrival of high-speed craft into the marine craft section was driven in part by Lawrence. He had previously witnessed a seaplane crew drowning when the seaplane tender sent to their rescue was too slow in arriving. He worked with Hubert Scott Payne, the founder of the British Powerboat Company, to introduce the 37.5-foot-long ST-200 seaplane tender Mark I into service. These boats had a range of 140 miles when cruising at 24 knots and could achieve a top speed of 29 knots. Lawrence was a keen motorcyclist and owned 8 Brough Superior motorcycles at different times. His last SS-100 is privately owned, but has been on loan to the National Motor Museum, Bewley, and the Imperial War Museum in London. He was also an avid reader of Thomas Malory's Le Morte d'Arthur and carried a copy on his campaigns. He read an account of Eugene Vinaver's discovery of the Winchester manuscript of the Morte in the Times in 1934, and he motorcycled from Manchester to Winchester to meet Vinaver. So that ties in with his fascination with the Crusaders. Le Morte d'Arthur, that was around that time. So, I mean, he's had a really interesting life, hasn't he? He's done all sorts of things. And I think he most enjoyed himself when he was in the RAF. That was his favourite.
So I guess he was, you know, to some extent as well, a bit of a petrol head in his liking for motorcycles, his liking for tanks, his liking for aircraft, for marine aircraft, etc. That's all. And as you said earlier on, instead of enlisting under his name of T. Lawrence, in which case he may have been offered an officer's position where he'd be desk bound, he preferred to be hands on and to be the person driving and flying these things.
Yeah, he also must have been really into his speedboats, and then came up with the idea of, well, let's modify these speedboats so that we can make something that can go out and rescue the crew from a seaplane, if necessary. Well, sadly, on the 13th of May 1935, Lawrence was fatally injured in an accident on his Brough Superior SS-100 motorcycle in Dorset, close to his cottage, Clouds Hill, near Wareham, just 2 months after leaving military service. A dip in the road obstructed his view of two boys on their bicycles, and he swerved to avoid them, lost control, and was thrown over the handlebars. He died 6 days later, on 19th of May, 1935, aged 46, and the location of the crash is marked by a small memorial at the roadside. One of the doctors attending him was neurosurgeon Hugh Cairns, who consequently began a long study of the loss of life by motorcycle dispatch riders through head injuries. And his research led to the use of crash helmets by both military and civilian motorcyclists. So he probably didn't have a crash helmet on. The Morton estate borders Bovington Camp, and Lawrence bought Clouds Hill from his cousins, the Frampton family. He had been a frequent visitor to their home, Oakerswood House, and had corresponded with Louisa Frampton for years. Lawrence's mother arranged with the Framptons to have his body buried in their family plot in the separate burial ground of St Nicholas's Church, Morton. And the coffin was transported on the Frampton Estate's bier. Mourners included Winston Churchill, E.M. Forster, Lady Astor, and Lawrence's youngest brother, Arnold. But that's not all, because there is a conspiracy theory about this. Almost immediately, rumours cropped up of a mysterious black car that ran Lawrence off the road. And shadowy sources alleged that Lawrence was killed by MI5 on the orders of Winston Churchill. Rumours are wonderful things. They can be born out of thin air and take on lives of their own. But that does not seem to be the case with Lawrence. Dorset historian Rodney Legg and Lawrence biographer Desmond Stewart both believe that Lawrence was assassinated. 4 witnesses stated that they saw the mysterious black car, the 2 children who were involved in the incident, a man in a delivery van, and a soldier, one private catchpole who happened to be in a nearby field. The children were kept incommunicado in a hospital, and did not testify at the inquest, which was conducted, oddly enough, at Bovington Camp and controlled by MI5 rather than by the local police. Catchpole did testify about the black car, but he conveniently killed himself shortly thereafter. The inquest was held in the morning and Lawrence was buried in the same afternoon. But why? Why would Lawrence be considered a threat? Well, the answer has to do with his political leanings. Around the time of his death, Lawrence was aligning himself with Sir Oswald Mosley, leader of the British Union of Fascists. And when he sustained the injuries that led to his death, Lawrence had been on his way to see his good friend, Hawthornden Prize winner Henry Williamson, who was facilitating a meeting between Lawrence and Adolf Hitler. Lawrence, like other veterans of World War I, abhorred the idea of yet another war in Europe, and, like Mosley and Williamson, he saw dialogue with Hitler as a necessary first step to preventing it. In 1935, Lawrence was still a national hero. Mosley advocated peace, but there was an active war lobby in England, and it is thought that Lawrence was about to publicly embrace the peace movement. This would have been very embarrassing to the war lobby. At this far a remove, it would be difficult to prove Lawrence's fatal injuries were other than accidental, but the circumstantial evidence is considerable. Forensic examination in this instance would provide little. It doesn't take a political historian to realise that the recruitment of a national figure like Lawrence would have boosted Mosley's movement, but only the release of information from MI5 and the British government could potentially shed any light on the circumstances of the accident, and that is highly unlikely to happen. Like much of his life, the details of T.E. Lawrence's death will remain in the shadows. And I did also hear that he was actually on his way to join the British Union of Fascists when this happened, when he was assassinated. So it is certainly plausible. Max, what are your thoughts on this? Have you heard of this conspiracy theory before?
I have heard this conspiracy theory, yeah. I think the fact that MI5 hijacked the investigation into his death, etc., that all stinks, really. And you have to say to yourself, you know, if any ordinary person who just happened to be a bit famous were to die in a road accident, would MI5 take over the situation and prevent the local police from being involved? There are grounds to be suspicious, but as you said, you know, this far removed in time, it's going to be impossible to prove anything unless you were able to obtain the Secret Service files relating to Lawrence's death.
Well, I guess it's normally 100 years, isn't it? So, you know, they must be coming up soon. They must be released soon. I mean, what are we up, 2022 now? And when did they say his death here was then?
I think it was 1935.
1935. So we've got another 12, 13 years to go. And then we'll be able to have a look at the MI5 files, I think. And
Assuming they don't put another delay on it, because there have been similar sort of events that have come up for the 100th anniversary where the security services have asked for that 100-year period to be extended to 150 years, for example.
Yeah, so it could be done if there's certainly interest in T.E. Lawrence and support for him still, and there is still support for him. I mean, he was a great hero of the nation at the time when this happened. He was a prolific writer throughout his life, a large portion of which was epistolary. He often sent several letters a day, and several collections of his letters have been published. He corresponded with many notable figures, including George Bernard Shaw, Edward Elgar, Winston Churchill, Robert Graves, Noel Coward, E.M. Forster, Siegfried Sassoon, John Buchan, Augustus John and Henry Williamson. He met Joseph Conrad and commented perceptively on his works. The many letters that he sent to Shaw's wife Charlotte are revealing as to his character. Lawrence was a competent speaker of French and Arabic and a reader of Latin and ancient Greek. He published three major texts in his lifetime. The most significant was his account of the Arab Revolt in the Seven Pillars of Wisdom. Homer's Odyssey and The Forest Giant were translations, the latter an otherwise forgotten work of French fiction. He received a flat fee for the second translation and negotiated a generous fee plus royalties for the first. That's interesting. I didn't realise he was the one to translate Homer's Odyssey. He was given lots of awards. He was appointed a Companion of the Order of the Bath on the 7th of August 1917, appointed a Companion of the Distinguished Service Order on 10th of May 1918, awarded the Knight of the Legion of Honour in France on 30th of May 1916, and awarded the Cross de Guerre also in France on 6th of April 1918. So even though he was, even though they didn't like him in France, they still ended up giving him awards. King George V, yes. That's interesting. King George V offered Lawrence a knighthood on the 30th of October 1918 at a private audience in Buckingham Palace for his services in the Arab Revolt, but he declined. He was unwilling to accept the honour in light of how his country had betrayed the Arabs. A bronze bust of Lawrence by Eric Kennington was placed in the crypt of St Paul's Cathedral, London, on 29th of January 1936, alongside the tombs of Britain's greatest military leaders. A recumbent stone effigy by Kennington was installed in St Martin's Church, Wareham, Dorset, in 1939. An English Heritage blue plaque marks Lawrence's childhood home at 2 Polstead Road, Oxford, and another appears on his London home at 14 Barton Street, Westminster. Lawrence appears on the album cover of Sgt Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles, and in 2002, Lawrence was named 53 in the BBC's list of the 100 greatest Britons following a UK-wide vote. In 2018, he was featured on a £5 coin, issued in silver and gold in a 6-coin set, commemorating the centenary of the First World War, produced by the Royal Mint. There's a bit of chutzpah for you, isn't it, if they did actually end up bumping him off and then they're still putting him on their coinage. he's definitely got some integrity, hasn't he? Refusing to accept a knighthood for his services in the Arab Revolt because Britain backed down on what they had promised the Arabs. He certainly led a very interesting life, a very noble life, a very honourable life, and he helped out these Arabs. And the Arabs obviously really took to him. It just shows you that, you know, that we're so adaptable as British people. We can adapt to our surroundings and still, you know, come out on top and beat everybody else. I mean, he was definitely one of our elites and one of our alpha males. Max, any thoughts on him and before we round up for today?
Yeah, I think his was a life of honour, a life of high energy and daring do. And I think he is a sort of boy's own kind of hero, isn't he? That any boy from any generation would feel awed by learning about.
Yeah, and his loyalty was to his nation and to his country. Even when he thought that the country had done wrong and they did wrong to the Arabs, his loyalty was still to his nation. That was most important. And then after the war, he accepted that and he supported Winston Churchill's plans for the Middle East. So he was loyal right until the very end. Even if he didn't agree with what the country was doing, he was loyal to them. Yeah, a very great man and a worthy addition to our greatest Britons.
Thank you very much for listening, and watch out for more in our Greatest Britons series of presentations here at Radio Albion in the future.